Paper Ghosts is a production of iHeartRadio.
Among the cold cases, 20-year-old Susan LaRosa vanished on a trip to a store in Rockville in 1975.
She was supposed to go there to get the baby some formula and to call my mom from the payphone, and she never came home.
The disappearance of Susan LaRosa has never officially been associated with the other missing girls. Her face or her case was never included on those missing person flyers posted around town. To law enforcement, there was no connection. Maybe because she was more than a decade older than the youngest of the girls. Still, as an investigator, I can't ignore facts. One of which is that within a 7-year span, Susan LaRosa became the fourth female to go missing, not just in the same town, but within a few miles of one another and, in three of the cases, merely blocks away. I've asked the Vernon PD if they ever considered these cases the work of a serial killer. When I hear of disappearances so similar, occurring in the same general location, it's hard to ignore the potential. But as I began speaking with detectives in 2009, the year I started my investigation, they said they had looked at every possibility but discounted it. I've interviewed serial killers throughout my career, written 7 books about them. And the one common admission they all have shared is that there are no coincidences when children go missing within this close proximity. And that you need to look not only for victim profile similarities, but location, time of day, and opportunity. One serial killer, who I've interviewed for the past 8 years, insists that when the obvious presents itself, believe it. Because most serial abduction cases are not the work of a diabolical genius or criminal mastermind. They are committed by a disorganized deviant, hyper-focused on one goal, who will make mistakes. As he's told me, find those common mistakes and you find your killer. You can hear him here in an interview I conducted years ago as he puts the mindset of a serial killer into perspective. His name? Keith Hunter Jesperson, the happy face killer.
There's a wonderment of whether or not I want to kill or not. I'm kind of wired maybe a little different than most. Like, you know, most serial killers are not criminals. You understand this, right?
Explain.
Whereas a serial killer is not necessarily a criminal at all. He's just a killer. In other words, I won't go out of my way to rob someone. I won't home invade. I won't do this. Well, of course, BTK did, but he didn't go in there to rob. He went in to kill. Our motive is actually just to kill.
Previously on Paper Ghosts.
She was with a group of young men and her friend, who was the same age as her, and they went joyriding. There was drinking involved, and they decided to throw pumpkins out the window and were pulled over. And they took Lisa to the state police barracks.
She came over to my house. She wanted to leave my mom and dad a note saying that she was very sorry and you know, embarrassed that, you know, we got in trouble.
And at that point, she decided, you know, she was going to leave and try and hitchhike home and never made it home.
And I'll never forget it. She came to my house in a flurry and she said, I wish it was you. I wish it was you that was dead.
My name is M. William Phelps. This is Paper Ghosts. The connection between Susan LaRosa and one of the other missing girls became apparent to me when I was speaking to Maria Scrow, who you heard in the last episode. Maria was Lisa White's best friend and the last person to see Lisa alive, minutes before she presumably hitchhiked home alone. Maria told me she used to babysit for the LaRosa family. Think about that for a moment. Lisa White's best friend babysat for a girl who would herself go missing a year after Lisa. I had never heard this before, and I know law enforcement had no clue. Not one detective had ever asked the question. And to be fair, why would they? But knowing what I now know, it has to be considered. Cold case work is as much about inclusion as it is about exclusion. Susan was a young mom, just 20 years old, and already she had three young children. She had dark black hair cut just above her shoulders, Peter Pan style. Susan was petite, 4 feet, 8 inches tall, 95 pounds, green eyes. That's the extent of what you'd know about Susan LaRosa if you read about her case in the newspapers. But after years of looking into her story and reviewing documents never before seen by the public, I knew better than to take anything at face value.
You got to understand, our family was a very fractured family. There wasn't much love or attention.
That's Ann Prentice, one of Susan LaRosa's four sisters. Ann was the second oldest, just 1 year younger than Susan.
My mother only had attention or time for Sue. Sue was her grandchild, and the other children really didn't exist. Sue was a lot of trouble. Sue was into drugs. Sue had abortions. Sue had overdoses. She had... She would run off with this guy, that guy. She was having sex with my uncles. It was a hell house. And then Sue got married to Robert, and she moved out. And my mother seemed to be happy at that point. She thought, wow, somebody took her off my hands, and he's going to make everything wonderful.
Robert is Bob LaRosa. Susan was 18 when she moved out of her family's home and married Bob. Throughout my interviews and research, I've developed two varying versions of how they met. One person, close to Bob, told me he met Susan while she was in a psychiatric hospital as he was there visiting someone else. That, same as lots of public reports and other information I've dug up in Susan's case, is false. Susan and Bob lived less than a mile from each other on Crystal Lake. There can be no doubt they hooked up because they were neighbors, which is the version everyone of Susan's immediate family members agrees with. Ever since Susan's disappearance in 1975, her family is kept out of the media spotlight. I've spoken to many of them over the years about when they'd feel ready to talk about what happened to Susan, and they believe it's now or never.
So my sister Anna.
Terry Shanks is Susan LaRosa's youngest sister.
Tell me about Bob. What kind of guy is Bob to your sister?
Bob LaRosa was a very quiet kind of guy. Their dynamic was kind of odd. Like, she wasn't the best housekeeper, wasn't the best cook. She, one time baked cake and it fell apart, so she scotch taped it together and thought it would be okay, but you know, whatever. She was just a free spirit kind of gal.
Would you say he was a good husband to her?
Yes, I do. I wish he would have been better in that he would have been stronger and crushed her when it came to the kids as far as her discipline. He was never home. He was always, I used to go scrap metaling with him. He didn't have a real job. He and I used to drive around the lake and Stafford area and look for scrap metal, and then we'd go to the junkyard and sell it so he could put food on the table.
Susan and Bob had two sons, Maurice, who goes by Mo, and Robert, Robbie Jr., and a daughter, Stacy, the oldest. Each child is 9 months apart, but there was something about Susan's middle child, Terry says, that turned Susan off, that scared her. Susan did not like the middle child, Robbie, and for whatever reason, treated him the most poorly out of the three.
My sister Sue was not a good mother. She was a horrible mother, actually. She was an abusive mother. She didn't know how to love. She didn't know how to be a mom. These kids were not what she wanted. They never were what she wanted.
And was Bob involved in drugs?
To my knowledge, no. to my knowledge, he was not.
Would you say she loved Bob?
In her way, yes. She had an odd way of... Susan was a brilliant young woman. She was brilliant. But unfortunately, she got involved with heroin. Yeah, that was a demon she had before she met Robert. So Robert was sort of like someone that was helping save her.
On the day Susan LaRosa went missing, June 22nd, 1975, her husband Bob told police Susan left their Rockville, Connecticut apartment in the early evening to go to the nearby drugstore, something she did every day, and never returned home. I wondered what Terry recalled from those early days after her sister vanished. Feelings, thoughts, memories. To me, the questions we ask are as important as the answers we get.
A month to the day that she went missing was her 21st birthday. And she always told my mom, on my 21st birthday, I'm coming by the house. I'm going to be streaking. You watch. You wait for me. You wait for me. I'm going to come running by. You know, streaking being totally buck naked. That was her plan. So my mom, the whole day, sat there, probably smoked 3 packs of cigarettes, waiting. This kills me every time. But she never came. She never came. And that's when everything fell apart. My mother could not. She did not have a function. She did not know what to do. She didn't know what to do. She didn't know how to walk. She didn't know how to talk. She didn't know how to be. Susan was her firstborn. Susan, at the same time, Susan and my mom went through a lot together. They were very close. They had a very close bond.
To get a better understanding, I need to take a look at what happened on the night Susan LaRosa disappeared. There are facts I can report with absolute certainty, facts made public here for the first time in 45 years, which begin to not only answer a lot of questions, but lead me to clues in several of the other missing girl cases. For example, I know from law enforcement documents written the day after Susan went missing that Bob LaRosa told police he and Susan argued because Susan struck one of the kids. Again, here's Susan's sister, Terry Shanks.
She went off on a little one, and she backhanded him, split his head open. Kid was bleeding profusely.
So you're talking about the night she went missing that,
yes,
that she hit?
She did hit, yes. She did hit him.
In a police report I've obtained, Bob LaRosa claims Susan hit their middle child, Robert, who was only 18 months old at the time. The injury caused Robert to bleed. The family has always believed it was a wound to the boy's head, but police reports confirm it was his bottom lower lip and that the cut was not bad at all. This all happened on the day Susan disappeared. There's no mention of a head wound. According to Bob, Susan then grabbed a $10 bill and a quarter and left the apartment. Bob said Susan left their apartment at approximately 6:30 p.m. to go to the drugstore to call her mother and pick up baby formula. There was only one drugstore nearby, Arthur's Drugs. Susan was there every day, same time, using the payphone, buying cigarettes and baby items. Maria Scrow, the LaRosa babysitter and Lisa White's best friend, confirmed this detail for me. That Susan would call her mother every day from a payphone at Arthur's Drugs, just a few short blocks west of the LaRosa's apartment. When Susan failed to return home, Bob called relatives with no results. At 12:39 p.m. the next day,
18 hours later, Bob LaRosa called the Vernon PD to report Susan was missing. He said his wife did not come home, but he did not want to file a missing person report yet. It was not until later that same day, near dark, when Bob decided to file one. The question is, why wait almost 24 hours later before filing a report?
How long you been major crimes now, Bill?
It's been a total of about 6 years now in investigations.
Lieutenant Bill Myers been with the Vernon Police and now heads major crimes since 2002. He stands 6 feet or so and has that familiar buzz cut you'd expect to see on a cop. Bill is one of the most practical investigators I know in the Tri-Town region. He is unafraid to say when cops have made mistakes or they go above and beyond, which is something I greatly appreciate. That kind of honesty and self-evaluation is imperative when reinvestigating cold cases. I've known Bill for a long time and have an immense amount of respect for the guy. He stopped by my office one morning as I was immersed in the cases. We stood in my garage, talking, catching up. He explained a few things to me off the record, putting a new perspective on the notion that what you read and hear online about cold cases is likely 50% or more bullshit. You really have to see actual documents and photos to truly understand what you're working with. And in these cases, those resources, including interviews with witnesses and family and even suspects, is really all we have to go on. What's the worst investigation you've been involved in Vernon? Off the top of your head.
I mean, there's definitely different ways to categorize worst.
The ones that keep you up at night.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the child cases, especially with young children.
Is there a lot of sexual exploitation going on still?
We get a lot.
A lot, huh?
Several a month, yeah.
Yeah.
A lot.
If we go back to the 60s and 70s, women, families didn't report that stuff, right?
No. It was a different time.
And I think they were scared that, A, the police wouldn't believe them. Certainly their parents wouldn't believe them, right? And a lot of people have told me that I've interviewed in all these cases have said, you know, we were told what happens in this house stays in this house, you know?
Yeah, in the 80s, I mean, domestic violence really came of age. Tracy Thurman case out in Torrington was kind of one of the turning points in Connecticut and across the country.
The Tracy Thurman case was a high-profile watershed moment in the country with regards to how domestic violence was viewed. In May 1983, Tracy Thurman called the Torrington, Connecticut Police Department and reported that her estranged husband had beaten her and was now threatening to kill her. The Torrington police told Tracy to come back in 3 weeks when the officer handling domestic cases returned from vacation. 2 weeks later, she called again. This time, one officer arrived, and 21-year-old Tracy lay critically wounded from multiple stab wounds, bloodied in her front yard as her husband stood over her with a knife. The husband was not arrested. He even kicked Tracy in the head in front of the officer. It was not until her husband tried to assault her as she lay on a stretcher and was being placed inside an ambulance that he was finally put in handcuffs. Tracy sued the town. There was a book and movie made about the case, and Tracy became the face of domestic violence reform. Bill continues, explaining it from a law enforcement perspective 30, 40 years ago, and the reality, honestly, is sickening.
Police used to handle domestic violence just with a warning, you know, and they would tell husbands, you know, control your wife or go back inside, don't call us. Now, completely different procedures. I mean, with mandatory arrests and mandatory referral to services, and our focus is really on stopping the cycle of domestic violence.
But it wasn't just men abusing women. A subject rarely talked about then was women abusing men, or wives abusing their husbands. Susan didn't limit her abuse to just her children. I've learned from her sister Anne that Bob was subject to her violence as well.
I saw her crack him over the head with a cast iron frying pan where he needed stitches, and he didn't do a thing about it because it just wasn't in him to do that. And he put up with a lot.
So we know violence was common in the LaRosa home, most definitely from Susan. According to a police report I've obtained, within the year leading up to her disappearance, Susan had actually stabbed Bob during a heated argument and abused her children. So, if abusers could get away with beating and stabbing their spouses, think about what else they got away with inside the home.
It was a gruesome discovery. Kind of the last thing loggers widening an interstate here in Vernon, Connecticut would have ever thought they'd come upon.
Unlike the other missing girl cases I've been investigating, Susan LaRosa's story actually had tangible evidence. On May 19, 1978, about 3 years after she went missing, construction workers widening Interstate 86 in Vernon, Rockville, discovered what was left of Susan's body in a wooded area off an old logging road. This was about 3.6 miles away from the LaRosa apartment. Today, as it was back then, the area is dense woods and very secluded. The kind of place where kids in the 70s and 80s held keg parties and bonfires. I can say from my experience as an investigator and someone who has lived in the town most of my life, whoever dumped Susan LaRosa's body out there knew that area very well.
That's not where you're going to dump a body if you're not in a hurry. You know, if Susan fell victim to a serial killer, I don't think that's where they would have found her.
Retired Detective John Collins was the lieutenant in charge of major crimes for the Vernon Police Department back in 2002. In 2004, his department made a concerted effort to reopen Susan LaRosa's case. There is, arguably, no one else who knows more about Susan's murder than John Collins. Susan was found fully clothed. Her pants fly was unbuttoned and her zipper down. She had no other injuries besides a fatal fracture to her skull. She only had 2 dimes and a nickel. That's 25 cents in her pocket. Remember, Bob LaRosa told police Susan took $10 and a quarter when she left the house. He made a point several times during several interviews over the years to say a quarter. Why would Susan have, then, 2 dimes and a nickel on her? Well, a payphone call in Connecticut in 1975 cost a dime. Was Bob suggesting that his wife had a quarter because finding 2 dimes and a nickel on her meant she must have reached the drugstore after leaving their home and exchanged the quarter to make her daily call to her mother? Much different from the other missing young girls I've been investigating, law enforcement had leads to go on with regard to Susan's disappearance. Mainly, a crime scene, albeit secondary because it was clear to the coroner and detectives that Susan was not murdered at the location her remains were found. They also had a huge breadcrumb to follow. The last person to see Susan alive before she went missing. Her husband, Bob LaRosa.
Even though Bob looked like a prime suspect, you know, we went about it with an open mind. And the information that we got didn't really point us in any other directions.
Weeks after Susan's body was discovered, Bob LaRosa was taken into police custody and questioned for 2 hours. At the time, law enforcement publicly stated Bob was not a suspect and foul play was not a path they were pursuing. It was a ploy, you know, to make him feel as though he was helping the investigation and he was not a person of interest. But in reality, there were no other suspects besides Bob. based on the police report, which has not been made public until now, Bob told police he believed Susan was not messing around with other guys. But to everyone in Susan's family at the time and later, when talking publicly to the Hartford Courant newspaper, Bob starkly contradicted himself, saying, quote, "I was under the impression that she took off with another guy. She was always flirting with other guys," end quote.
They had a very tumultuous relationship. There was cheating on both sides. There was indications of domestic violence, domestic issues. And as you know, when a woman goes missing or when a woman turns up dead, if you just blindly went and arrested the husband, you'd have a good batting average.
Family members have told me that Susan's emotional mental state was stable and her physical condition good on the day she disappeared. But Bob would routinely chastise his wife's mental state to her family. He consistently told one story to police and a different story to family and friends, which, in the eyes of law enforcement, made him a prime suspect. The truth is inherent, infallible. It does not change. At one point during that interview, a detective, in what I think is a brilliant Columbo-like move, casually explained to Bob that if he had, you know, accidentally killed his wife, it would be considered, quote, negligent homicide. Bob's response to that? How much time will I get?
An innocent person doesn't ask that question. 100 times out of 100 times, an innocent person does not ask that question.
There was never any official record of Bob being violent with Susan. But look, I'm far from naive. I've written extensively about domestic violence cases, many of which have ended in murder. The way it has always been explained to me by experts is this. In 75% of murder cases, the victim knows the murderer. According to the Centers for Disease Control, over half of the killings of women in America are related to intimate partner violence, with the vast majority of the victims dying at the hands of a current or former romantic partner. Staggering statistics. In other words, when a wife is murdered, you'd hit the bullseye just about every time if every dart you tossed was aimed at the husband. I had asked Susan's youngest sister, Terry, what she believed happened that night between Susan and Bob. The night Susan hit her middle child, split the inside of his lip, and supposedly left the apartment on her own to go to the drugstore.
I think that what happened was eventually he had it. I think one night he got home from work and shit happened.
So the theory the family has is
that either, okay, he went off on her because he couldn't take it anymore and he was trying to protect his kid. So he either took a piece of pipe that he always had in the house because he always collected it and knocked her with it, or he just knocked her down and she smashed her head against a tub.
Terry then described what else the family has always believed.
Because she did die of a fractured skull.
I pointed to my head and asked where, exactly.
It was in the back of the head.
Back of the head?
Back of the head.
Because I've heard now front of the head, and now I hear back of the head. Definitely back of the head.
Yes.
I didn't mention this during the interview, but I've seen the crime scene photos, which include close-ups of Susan's skull. She had no injuries to the back of her head. The injury that killed Susan LaRosa, according to her autopsy report, was to the front of her head, just above her forehead on the right side. Susan LaRosa stared at her killer as she was struck with a fatal blow to her head.
So you think Bob killed your sister?
Yes, I do.
Do you think he acted alone in the next step of that?
No, I do not.
In the next episode of Paper Ghosts.
I have night terrors. I see my mom. She's changing Mo on the changing table. She turned around and she slapped my brother in the face, right on the nose. And it bled. It bled. It was bleeding.
Did your dad ever have a station wagon?
We owned a station wagon.
The gentleman that was there, that showed up, he has on a red and black checkered flannel shirt, and he smells. Even now, to this day, I can't smell that smell without, like, freezing.
Paper Ghosts is written and executive produced by me, M. William Phelps, with help from producer Christina Everett and sound editing by Pete Cardi from Backroom Audio. A special thanks to Abu Safar and Will Pearson from iHeartRadio. The series theme, number 442, is written and performed by Tom Mooney and Thomas Phelps. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.